Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
This recording was made less than a month after the stock market crash that precipitated the Great Depression, when the devastating consequences of Black Friday were just becoming apparent. In fact, there were a lot of happy songs that were hits in the dark days of the Depression. Even Franklin Roosevelt used Happy Days as his 1932 presidential campaign theme to convey hope and optimism.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song.
I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, the music of the Depression. Later on the show, the New Deal.
I prefer, and I am sure you prefer, greater security for the average man than he has ever known before in the history of America.
But first, during the Great Depression, the entertainment industry created what many consider the greatest era of popular music. Standards like 10 Cents a Dance and Just a Gigolo have their roots in the Depression. Elliot Majerzyk is associate producer of With Good Reason, and he joins me today to play some of the songs that helped pull America through the hard times. Elliot, tell me something about music of the Depression. Is it all depressing?
No, actually it isn't. There were like two strains that I was finding. One was the depressing aspect, you know, soldiers, laborers, farmers who had invested in the country and now suddenly found themselves on the street. That's the worst of America. And then you have the best of America, which was, we're going to get through this. We're going to keep on keeping on. We're going to have a smile on our face. We're stronger than the Depression. So you have both.
So let me go to the first song that you have. And this one is Riddle Me This.
Yeah, this is a kind of interesting song, very cynical song. And it was written by the writer Yipsel Harburg. Now, you might not know who Yipsel Harburg was, but he wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Now, Somewhere Over the Rainbow is a beautifully optimistic song, but Riddle Me This is quite the opposite. Who got us into this mess? You know, very almost like a provocative song, a politically provocative song for the era.
Here's some of the lyrics. Riddle me this. Who's the mastermind of this puppet show? Whom do we pay? Who's the croupier? Who's the one that sweeps all the stakes away?
Well, that's a question that could be asked in 2008 today. People are still wondering, you know, who's the mastermind of this? And he's comparing life to a casino where the proverbial person in Las Vegas who's just, you know, thinks he's going to beat the house, but the house always wins.
Where do we turn? Where do we go? Riddle me this. Who's the mastermind of the puppet show? Riddle me this. Whom do we pay? Who's the croupier? Riddle me this. Who's the one that sweeps all the stakes away? Riddle me this. Love a little, sin a little, play the game and win a little, only to lose. Listen to the money jingle, isn't it a funny jingle ending with blue? What is the song? What is the rhyme? Riddle me this. Are there any odds on the wheel of time? Riddle me this.
You know, it doesn't sound like a cynical song, but as you point out, the lyrics are.
Right. Well, that's interesting because it's often a device in popular music is to put a very happy song with something that's a little down, so it sort of sneaks up on you. Actually, that's the chemistry that works. Yipsel Harburg, what a name. When I first heard of it, he was Jewish, and I thought it was like a Yiddish name, Yipsel. It's actually an acronym for the Young People's Socialist League, and Yipsel was very much a socialist at the time, even though he was a writer in Tin Pan Alley, and that comes through the lyrics. Now, you know, let's flip the record over in terms of let's look at the other side, which was the optimist music of the era, and nobody could write optimistic, looking forward, be proud that you're American, things are going to get better than Irving Berlin. Now, Irving Berlin wrote, God Bless America. And he also wrote White Christmas, which was a whole other story because he was Jewish from the Lower East Side, but he writes the best Christmas song ever written about America, in America. And he wrote this song called Let's Have Another Cup of Coffee. And basically it is, no matter how tough times are, I still have you. Let's have a piece of pie. Let's have another cup of coffee. Let's forget about everything that's going on around us. Things are going to get better. We have each other.
Just around the corner, there's a rainbow in the sky. So let's have another cup of coffee, and let's have another piece of pie. Troubles like a bubble, and the clouds will soon roll by. So let's have another cup of coffee, and let's have another piece of pie. Let a smile be your umbrella, or it's just an April shower. Even John D. Rockefeller is looking for the silver lining. Mr. Herbert Hoover says that now's the time to buy. So let's have another cup of coffee, and let's have another piece of pie.
That's such a great piece. I love that song. And as many times as I've heard it, I'd never heard the references to Hoover and Rockefeller.
Well, yes, Sarah, do you imagine a song today reaching number one that would have references to Bernanke and Bush and the financial crisis and the bailout? You know, it's interesting. People talk about topical songs starting from the 60s, but the roots of those topical and so-called protest songs are in the Depression era music. This is a standard called 10 Cents a Dance. Actually, Michelle Pfeiffer sang it in the movie The Fabulous Baker Boys, which starred Jeff and Beau Bridges. But it was written by Rodgers and Hart, and Rodgers and Hart are, you know, two of the American premier songwriters. My Funny Valentine, Isn't It Romantic? And they wrote a song about the dance halls of the time. Now, what was happening in the Depression is that there were a lot of lonely guys on the street who were split up from their family, and they needed some companionship. So they would go into a dance hall and pay 10 cents to dance with a woman and talk to her while dancing, just to forget about their troubles for a while. This is a song written from the point of view of one of the women talking about how hard her life is.
10 cents a dance, that's what they pay me. Gosh, how they weigh me down. 10 cents a dance, pansies and rough guys, tough guys who tear my gown. 7 to midnight, I hear drums.
You know, in the history of pop music, there's always been kind of answer songs. If something gets a hit, so they put up a song that may be an answer to it. Well, there was another song, was sort of from the male point of view, and was the famous song Just a Gigolo. It was a huge hit for Louis Prima in 1956. So let's hear sort of the rockin' version of Just a Gigolo that a lot of people may remember from the 50s, and then we'll hear the original version.
And just a gigolo, and everywhere I go, people know the part I'm playing. Paid for every dance, selling its romance. Oh, what they say. There will come a day, and youth will pass away. What will they say about me? When the end comes, I know there's just a gigolo. Life goes on without me.
It doesn't sound like a sad song. It sounds like he enjoys his work.
Right. But the original song was actually a lot, lot sadder. It was written in Austria after World War I, and it was about this German cavalry officer who would strut around with his medals, but nobody would want him, and he was starving, and the only way he could earn some money was to be a male escort for women. And the song was a huge hit in Europe, and somebody, I guess, in America heard it and decided to re-record it. And the version we're going to hear is by Bing Crosby. But when you listen to Crosby doing Just a Gigolo, he infuses it with a real personality. You're hearing the person behind the song, and it actually really becomes a tragic song.
Was in a Paris cafe, but first I found him. He was a Frenchman, a hero of the war. But war was over, and here's how peace had crowned him. a few cheap medals to wear and nothing more. Now every night in this same cafe he shows up, and as he strolls by, ladies hear him say, if you admire me, hire me. A gigolo knew a better day. Just a gigolo, everywhere I go, people know the part I'm playing. Paid for every dance, selling each romance, every night some heart betrayed. There will come a day, youth will pass away, then what will they say about me? When the end comes, I know they'll say just a gigolo, as life goes on without me.
Oh, Elliot, that is so beautiful. It makes me wish that we had musicians of that caliber singing our pop tunes nowadays.
Well, yes. I mean, you can put the blame on American Idol, or, you know, Bing Crosby wouldn't make it past the tryouts in American Idol maybe today, because it's all about technique. But it's not about singing. It's not about a personality, somebody talking to you through the lyrics of the song and embodying the song.
The next Depression-era song that you've suggested we listen to is Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
Well, you know, it's been called the spiritual anthem of the dispossessed people of the Depression. Again, it was written by Yipsel Harburg. There was a march on Washington by thousands of World War I veterans who were now homeless, destitute, and they felt that they had given their best to the country. They were seeking bonuses that Congress had promised them. And how were they rewarded? Their march was routed by forces led by none other than General Douglas MacArthur. The version I'd like to play was recorded by Bing Crosby in one take, and it immediately became the top-selling record in America within a week. It touched a nerve as to what was going on at that time.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
I read around this time that Hoover commented that the rations of the soldiers in America's military should not be cut in case they needed to be in good form to quell citizen uprisings during the Depression from those who were hungry and desperate.
You know, it's interesting that some of the most creative outputs in art and music has been through hard times. As a matter of fact, Yipsel Harburg, who wrote that song, told the late writer Studs Terkel in an interview, and I'm going to read what he said. He said, "I was relieved when the crash came. Being in business was something I detested. When I found out I could write a song or a poem, I became alive. When I lost my possessions, I found my creativity." It's interesting that the times of challenge and tribulation in America produces great art. The Depression and World War II was a wonderful era for music. It might have been a terrible era in other ways to live through, but music had a certain renaissance in these times.
It really did, and it's such a treat to go back and hear these pieces and understand what was behind each one of them. What do you have in store for us as maybe a last piece we can play?
Well, it's kind of a wish for us all. you know, I hope we're all singing this song, you know, when we meet again. We'll, as they say, as Vera Lynn sang in World War II, we will sing this song. And what's this song? We're in the Money. Now, most people know this song from the film Gold Diggers of 1933, and it was originally sung by Ginger Rogers. But the version I'm going to choose was sort of Harlem's answer to the Gold Diggers of 1933. It's my favorite version of We're in the Money. It's sort of a scat singing by the great African-American band leader and singer Benny Morton.
Yes, we're in the money. We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes, oh, to get along. I got myself some money. The skies are so sunny. Old man, the president, you done us, though you're wrong. We never see a headline about a bread line today. And when we see the landlord, you can look that guy right straight in the eye.
You know, I never realized that that piece came from this era. I'm used to hearing it mostly when the NPR show Marketplace does the numbers for the day, the stock market numbers.
Well, it's unfortunate that you don't hear a lot of this music on the radio anymore. It was great then. There's a reason it was great. And Sarah, if another record was never released ever again and no other CD ever came on the market, you could really spend the rest of your life catching up.
Well, Elliot Majerzyk, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you for sharing your insights about Depression-era music with me today on With Good Reason.
I had a great time, Sarah. Thank you.
Elliot Majerzyk is the associate producer of With Good Reason. Coming up next, The New Deal. In this unstable economy, many are looking for the government to take drastic action, as Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s with the New Deal, putting millions of Americans to work. My next guests are two scholars of that era in American history. Nigel Sellers is a professor of history at Christopher Newport University. Eric Rauschway is a history professor at the University of California, Davis. Eric, let me start with you. Did Americans realize right after the crash that they were in a Great Depression, or is there a slower sort of dawning?
Well, Americans were pretty sure they were in a Great Depression by sometime in 1931 or 1932. The stock market crash of 1929 had precipitated a drop in consumer spending, which led pretty quickly to sharp rises in unemployment. So by the time you got into 1931, 1932, you had a prolonged period of double-digit unemployment. Lots and lots of people had lost their jobs.
The results following the crash are fairly grim. You've got places like Cleveland that had 50% unemployment. You have the auto industry down to 20% of capacity, the steel industry down to 12%. People who did have jobs oftentimes found their wages cut, and many of them were unable to pay their mortgages on the homes that they'd purchased. Some people have argued that, in fact, within a few months of the crash, all of the gains made between 1921 to 1929 are actually wiped out.
When Roosevelt was elected, what do you think the expectations were of him?
Well, he was elected in November of 1932, and in many ways he was simply elected in part because he was not Herbert Hoover.
Yeah, I mean, despite coming from an extremely wealthy, old-line New York family, he really did have an extraordinary common touch. I mean, very early in the campaign in 1932, when he accepted the Democratic nomination, he promised a new deal to the American people, and he said that this would include public works, and this would include the restoration of international trade, and it would include watershed management and conservation, and it would include aid to farmers and to homeowners, and he sort of laid out a raft of possible solutions, many of which they actually ended up providing over the first two terms of his presidency.
It's easy to think today, back on the Depression, as a time when everyone was hand-wringing and hardly anything else could get done. But that wasn't really what was going on.
Well, the wealthy certainly were not experiencing terrible times. In fact, many of them probably benefited from the crash because the price of stocks went down. That's how Joseph Kennedy made a good portion of his fortune. but you had to have wealth in order to get that kind of wealth.
Yeah, when you think about the Great Depression and its effect on ordinary people, you have to, I think, realize how it kind of crept up on the average person, and there was a kind of rolling collapse. So at first, people would, if they went out of work, they would depend on their own savings, which meant that they withdrew money from banks, which made the banks more fragile. As time went on, local and sort of fraternal charities failed under the weight of the burden they were being asked to sustain, and the whole system just sort of came crashing to a halt. And so that when you had something like one in four American workers unemployed, there was really no formal aid for them. You know, people were never entirely helpless. People did undertake really desperate measures, though. I mean, you had an increased number of people going on the road in the hopes of finding work, which increasingly became a hopeless hope. But you really did have to get to a nationally desperate situation by 1933 in order for people to not only acquiesce in, but really cheer on the dramatic change that Roosevelt brought in with the New Deal.
What about those who were able to hold on to jobs? People that we might consider middle class now, how did the Depression manifest itself in their lives?
I think this is really key for understanding why you get the New Deal. I mean, when you look at a 25% unemployment rate, that's horrific. But what that, of course, means is that three out of four people are still employed. Nevertheless, the 25% unemployment rate is high enough that everybody who's still in work begins to feel the fragility of their own position. Whereas before, during the boom and go-go years of the 20s, the average middle-class American might have looked at, you know, Hollywood, might have looked at Wall Street and said, I am going to someday live like the rich. By the time you get to 1932, 1933, the average middle-class person is looking in the other direction on the social ladder and saying, it could be me. It could be me who's a tramp. It could be me who has to leave his family. It could be me who's out of work and depending on, you know, relatives and friends, or who's completely without food altogether. So the middle class begins looking in the other direction on the social ladder, begins sympathizing with people who are worse off rather than people who are better off.
Probably maybe one reason why the Great Depression was viewed the way it was for the first time, white-collar management-type workers were the ones who were also being affected. It was not simply manufacturing jobs that were affected anymore.
Was there a lot of dialogue about how this really isn't so bad, it's going to get better very soon, we're not really in a recession, we're not really in a depression?
Herbert Hoover was saying that more or less constantly from the moment of the crash to the moment he went out of office.
Yeah, there was a general sense of that recovery is just around the corner. And Americans turned so many corners in that few years that they never found a recovery.
So in simple terms, what was the New Deal?
The New Deal is traditionally divided into three parts. You have programs that are intended to provide immediate relief to people who are suffering the effects of the Great Depression. You have programs that are intended to spur a recovery from the Great Depression and set the economy back on its feet again. And then you have programs that are intended to institute reforms so that in future there will be fewer depressions and those that there are will have less effect on the average American.
And basically, Roosevelt approached it himself by saying that he was like a quarterback in a football game and that the next play depended on the success of the current play. And if something worked well in one place, that would be fine, but you don't do the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, Roosevelt himself used the phrase bold and persistent experimentation, which meant that, you know, they would try things, and the things that would work, they would keep on doing, and the things that didn't, they would abandon. And this is quite visible. I mean, the later stages of the New Deal look very different from the early stages of the New Deal because they'd abandoned their failures.
What was it about Roosevelt's otherwise patrician background that should have positioned him so well to be the overseer of this sort of turnaround in favor of the little guy?
Well, he had a very, very strong sense of noblesse oblige. It was instilled in him mostly by his mother, I believe, that the well-off really owe a duty to help those who are less fortunate. Being sick himself, having come down with what at the time was, I think, diagnosed as polio, that probably made him much more sympathetic to the sufferings of other people, since he himself had had to overcome a tremendous disability.
He did a lot of his recovering in Georgia from polio, so he would have seen both white and black people who were less well off during his time in Georgia, and that might have had an impact on him.
He does model himself somewhat on his cousin Teddy Roosevelt, and in some ways the basic thrust behind the New Deal is essentially a revival of the old progressive ideas, along with a healthy dose of populism.
In a way, what happens with the Depression is just that the resistance to all of these reforms is just let up, and they all go through a sort of in a series of enactments, and the movement for social welfare programs, like what becomes a Social Security Act, likewise goes back to the 19-teens and the hopes of urban reformers for making the lives of industrial workers more comfortable.
Huey Long, the former governor and then junior senator from Louisiana, many of Long's proposals eventually do become government programs.
Such as what?
They were raising issues. Well, he wanted to have government-funded loans for students to attend college, loans that would help people buy homes. But when you think about it, the Federal Housing Administration and later on the VA loans really owe a lot to these ideas that are most vocally proposed by Huey Long.
You have right away the Civilian Conservation Corps, which employs young men to do work preserving forests and securing highways and preventing forest fires. In the winter of 1933-1934, in response to continued high unemployment, Roosevelt establishes the Civil Works Administration, which directly employs about 4 million people for the federal government to do work during this very harsh winter.
Can you tick off a list of some of these projects so we'll know how enduring they were?
Let me see. For the WPA, there's a tremendous number, starting with the Federal Writers Project. Most states had a Federal Writers Project group. They're best known for the series of guidebooks that are still in print today. We also have the Post Office Mural Project, where artists were hired through the post office to paint murals displaying local historical scenes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the unique things about the WPA is its breadth, and people often remember the theater project and the writers' project, and also the effort to record American folk traditions of Appalachian Americans and African Americans who remembered slavery. But it's also important to remember that the WPA is principally a road-building agency. I mean, this is what they do. They build roads and airports, like LaGuardia Airport, or they build seaports, and they build schools. So this is tremendous public investment in infrastructure as a result of the New Deal.
What sort of arguments were put forth that were against this soaking the rich tax that grew out of this period?
Well, the principal argument against soaking the rich is, of course, you don't understand how recovery from this depression will occur. What will happen is that the rich will begin to invest their money once they have confidence again, and that will give the ordinary person jobs. We now think of this as trickle-down economics. So if you prevent the rich from investing their money, if you take their money instead and you have these WPA programs or murals or brochures or whatever it is, then you are preventing the economy from recovering, or anyway, that is the argument.
A good example of why the economy probably was not going to pick up otherwise is in 1938, there's some massive budget cutting because they assume that the economy is up and running again. And the minute that all these programs have their fundings cut, it plunges back down to near 1932 levels because the recovery was entirely the result of the government intervention.
Hard times, hard times. How long are you going to stay?
Nigel Sellers is a professor of history at Christopher Newport University. Eric Rauchway is a professor of history at the University of California, Davis, and the author of The Great Depression and the New Deal, A Very Short Introduction. You're listening to With Good Reason. Elliot Majerzyk and Jesse Dukes are associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Nancy King creates our feature capsules. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And Lydia Wilson is our publicity coordinator. We had help this week from Perry Smith of WHRV. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, for the Higher Education Broadcasting Consortium, and public radio stations serving Virginia. For a free copy of this show on CD or to comment, call 877-451-5098 or listen to past shows at our website, withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
I haven't got one penny. The rent man is standing at my door. I haven't got one penny. The red man is standing at my door. I think I'll give it up and let hard time take his own toll.